had my last cup of coffee for the morning and I had two cigarettes. Then I heard my mobile phone go off that there was a notification on there, and then bang.
You're listening to All the Best, a weekly documentary and storytelling show. I'm Jess Hamilton, and this week we're talking about picking up the pieces of something broken or lost, but not forgotten. Our first story is from South Australia, and it's been in the works for a couple of months now, and ever since we had this one pitched to us, we've been so excited to share it with you. Carrie Shear, who brings us this next story, has been working in Adelaide as a filmmaker, and that's how she met Stephen Lambert. Stephen hasn't seen his high school girlfriend in nearly 30 years. Things didn't really end so well the first time, but suddenly he has the opportunity to reconnect with her. The only thing is, something has changed in Stephen, something pretty big, and he's not so sure if his high school sweetheart is ready to find out.
In Stephen Lambert's kitchen, there's a bourbon dispenser mounted on the wall, right next to a corkboard covered in rock concert tickets, an overflowing ashtray on the table, and two gigantic speakers that blast music so loud the whole house shakes. One of the first things I learned about Stephen is that he loves to party.
Always have. That's why I party so much these days, because you never know when your last one's going to be.
Stephen is 46. He lives in the Barossa Valley in South Australia. I met him about a year ago when I interviewed him for this video project in his home. And when the interview was done, we had a drink and started chatting about life and how he was going.
I've been 80% happy. Yeah, the only hole in my life is I never had anyone to love.
Actually, Stephen had many lovers, including a wife. The thing was, that all felt so long ago, like a past life. He said he's accepted he's spending his life alone, and he isn't sitting around feeling sorry for himself. He's partying with friends, going to concerts, and enjoying his life. Nearly a year after we made that video, Stephen contacted me, saying he had some news.
I just finished my daily exercises, and I was doing my normal routine. I'd have my last cup of coffee for the morning and I had two cigarettes. Then I heard my mobile phone go off that there was a notification on there, and then bang. I dropped my cigarette. My heart was racing.
It was a Facebook notification for a community swap and sell page. Someone posted a list of items stolen from their home. It wasn't the post that made his heart race, though. It was the poster, Tracy Bilby.
It had been 27 years since I heard Tracy's name. Tracy was the first girl I fell in love with. She was a girl that I thought I was going to marry. But because we were so young, it was just never going to work at that point of time.
Stephen and Tracy first met when she was only 4 and he was 6. They grew up playing together as kids. But when they became teenagers, their relationship took a secret romantic turn.
I ended up jumping out of my bedroom window when my mum was asleep and jumping into Tracy's bedroom window when her parents were asleep. And that became on a regular thing. It was not getting caught that made it exciting.
Tracy's parents didn't want Stephen anywhere near their daughter. Back then, he was a wild, rebellious teenager, a DJ with long hair, tight denim jeans, and a terrible reputation with girls.
Please don't laugh, but my nickname was Horny. I should never have got that nickname, especially when a parent.
Stephen and Tracy had this intense secret love affair that lasted about 2 years. But in the end, Stephen lived up to his nickname.
Tracy was working at Hungry Jack's. I was driving in my car to pick her up and she was talking to another girl. The other girl said, I've got a boyfriend named Stephen Lambert. He's a DJ. And Tracy goes, that's funny. I've got a boyfriend named Stephen Lambert too. And before they were about to kill each other, I drove past my car, seen them both out there, and so I just kept driving away because I knew I'd been busted.
Was that the end of both of those relationships?
Yeah, pretty much. And I felt really bad, but I was only young. But if she kept hanging around me, she would have got herself into a lot of trouble. So it was probably better we drifted apart.
Their secret love affair ended. They grew up and out of each other's lives. Stephen actually tried to look Tracy up a few times over the years, but never found her. But here, out of the blue, nearly 30 years later, she was. Stephen wasted no time replying to her post.
Tracy, is that you? Been looking for you for a long time. Please make contact.
Within seconds, Stephen got a notification that Tracy responded.
Link Tracy Bilby, Steve. Do I know you?
He heard it through his screen reader.
Stephen, are you from Tisbury Street? I can't believe this. What's your telephone?
My phone kept going off. Stephen, you have a message from Tracy Bilby. I was getting so excited knowing that, you know, my first love was coming back into my life. But she needed to know who she's, or how I am today. That now my body's changed. I'm not the same person that I was 27 years ago.
Everyone changes from their teenage self, but Stephen had more than most. Today, he's blind, uses a wheelchair, and can only move one arm freely. And so he wrote to her, check out this video, here's where I'm at in life. And then he sent her the video we made together nearly a year before.
Got to line everything up in the exact position to be able to get myself in and out of bed.
It shows how he lives independently despite his challenges.
Yeah, it's extremely difficult, but I have to do it. That's my independence.
And then he waited for her response. After Stephen and Tracy broke off their secret love affair 27 years ago, Stephen spent several years partying hard, embracing his nickname, dating lots of women, DJing, traveling with bands, getting up to trouble every chance he got. But eventually he decided it was time for another chapter.
I sort of said, Stephen, it's time to do the right thing. Settle down, pull your head in, stop breaking hearts, get rid of horny. To be honest, I had a little black book, and I was dating 5 different girls, and I actually chose one that I wanted to settle down with. Had my daughter, decided that I was going to work harder and, you know, be the responsible father and take on my responsibilities and stand up to them, which I did. And then my journey of life, I thought I was going to just stay married and work until I was 65, and then my whole life was turned upside down. I woke up one morning and my arm felt numb, and I thought, well, I just slept on it the wrong way. And then I thought, normally it would go right away in a couple of hours, and I went all day and it was still there. That night, I said to my wife, my arm's still numb and I can hardly move my fingers. Then the next day, it was still there. Then I decided to see a doctor, and the GP said, I think it's about time we send you to a neurologist. I didn't even know what a neurologist was back then. And in the waiting room, everybody was lined up there in wheelchairs. I was the only one walking. And I just looked at him, I said, that'll never be me. It never happened to me.
How soon did it happen?
Within 2 years.
Stephen was 33 when the neurologist sent him away for some scans. When he came back, she diagnosed him with multiple sclerosis. It's a condition of the central nervous system, and it affects people very differently, from mild to severe. But for Stephen, it would be the latter.
There was little empathy from the neurologist. You know, we're in there for 10, 15 minutes and then bang, your life had changed. It was basically go home, read the book, contact the MS Society and deal with it. And I remember the neurologist said to me, your life's going to change forever now. And I said, well, no, I won't. I'll just go back to work. I was thinking, well, I can't get sick. You know, I've got too many responsibilities. I got a lot to offer in life. I can't get sick. I mean, I was young, you know. I was invincible. Getting sick wasn't even a thought in my mind.
Stephen hid his symptoms and went back to work at Holden, where he worked in the paint shop. And he got away with it for a while, but soon he started losing his balance. A sneeze would drop him to the ground. And it just couldn't be ignored any longer. And so he told his bosses what was going on. They tried to be supportive, and he kept working for a while, trying not to let on how weak he was feeling. Then one day, it got so bad, he stepped into his office, shut the door, and rang his wife.
And I said, look, can you ring up my boss and tell him I've got to be sent home? I'm not feeling too well. And I mean, I could have told my boss myself, but I was too scared to, because I didn't want them to see that there was a problem with me working. And she rang up my boss and said, look, Stephen needs to go home now. He's on more medication and he's sicker. And he automatically sent me home and I never went back to work. I could just feel myself deteriorating. And I think, nothing's happening. I just keep getting sicker and sicker and sicker. So then I rang up the neurologist at the Flinders Medical Centre and I said, look, whatever we have to do, news me, be a rat, news me, do whatever we have to do. This has got to stop. I just can't deal with this anymore. And so he admitted me into hospital straight away and we decided to put me on chemotherapy. And this is one of the first signs my marriage was deteriorating. When I was there, I was alone. I had that all by myself, and it was hard. I was alone.
Stephen told me his wife did come to all the rest of his chemo appointments, but their marriage was breaking down. I haven't spoken to Stephen's ex-wife, so I only have Stephen's account to go off. In the meantime, MS still had more havoc to wreak. It was the middle of the night. Stephen was rushed to hospital with severe pain all over his body. Everyone thought this was the end. It wasn't, but it was the night his vision went out.
I remember laying in the hospital, and all I could see was a black shade on the wall. That was somebody telling me I had to keep going. And I don't believe in spirits or ghosts or anything like that, but it was somebody. It was complete black shape of a human. And my vision went down, straight down to 1%. But I was alive. I thought, hey, I could deal with this. I'll just keep living. When I was diagnosed, I had three major fears. And one was losing my job, one was losing my driver's license, and one was losing my family. They were my three biggest fears, and they scared the hell out of me. And they didn't survive the illness. They all happened in sequence. But what did survive was me. When the heaven above gave me a second chance, I did actually make two pledges to myself. The first is a happy ending, and the second pledge is I want to be blind in a wheelchair and bloody proud of it.
Tracy Bilby was having a rough time in life and battling feelings of depression and loneliness. And so when her home got robbed, it just felt like the world had it in for her. When she posted in the Swap Sell Facebook page, she didn't have much hope she'd get any of her missing items back. And she didn't. But something much more important resurfaced.
Within moments, I had an answer back from a person by the name of Stephen Lambert. And I'm thinking, who's playing a cruel trick on me right now?
More than a decade ago, Tracy'd heard Stephen died in a surfing accident. She'd mourned his death and felt terrible that their last communication with each other had been angry. Tracy couldn't believe Stephen was alive, and it turns out they only live an hour apart. She was trying to wrap her mind around it all when he sent her a link to the video, which shows his present condition and how he lives independently.
I watched it and I cried, and I just cried and cried and cried, and he was my first love. He was just everything to me. He was my whole world. I couldn't believe that he'd been dealt such a harsh blow. I was sad for him. I was really upset. But then I saw that Stephen's attitude was, I'm not going to be put down. I'm not going to stop. This isn't going to stop me. And you could see that in the video. And I was really impressed.
She wrote back to him right away.
Oh my God, it's really you. I can't believe that. Thank you very much for the link you showed me. I can't believe you've gone through this. It just makes me think that you're a much stronger person.
Stephen then tells her she can come and visit him if she wants to.
And I'm like, hell yeah. So I jumped in the shower, threw some clothes on, jumped in the car.
I wasn't expecting, to be honest, I wasn't expecting a yes. It was more of unbelief.
Driving down, I'm questioning myself. Are you doing the right thing?
I was rolling inside and outside, and yeah, I think I had about 10 cigarettes in about 20 minutes.
Am I able to go through this? Am I able to see him the way I saw him beforehand?
And then when I heard a car come up the driveway, I spun around, ready to look her in the eye and greet her.
He was sitting there, and all I wanted to do was just touch him. And I just grabbed his hand and I just held his hand. I didn't want to let that hand go. And he at first was a little bit, I think, taken back by it.
It's been a long time since I've actually held a female's hand.
I mourned him. I mourned him for a long time, and it was quite sad. I was very upset and devastated. To find him alive was just, it was amazing. It was a miracle. It was like, oh my God, Horny's alive.
I knew that Tracy, because she did love me at that stage in her life, that she would always forgive me. I didn't think it would take 30 years, but it did.
I didn't see Stephen as his older person. I saw Stephen as the teenager that I went out with that was a horny little critter.
They held hands and talked for hours, catching each other up on the past 30 years. And before Tracy left, she kissed him goodbye.
It was a close kiss. It was an emotional kiss. You could feel straight away there was a lot more in it than what there was. And I couldn't believe it.
Tracy wanted to come back out straight away, but Stephen wouldn't let her.
I was scared. Am I going to get my heart broken? I was scared, but I wanted to let her into my life. But I wanted to know her as a person first.
They talked on the phone about 4 hours every day the whole next week. Stephen finally told her she could come back out. And they've basically been inseparable ever since, going on 6 months now.
I didn't think that there would be this attraction again in my life. I just thought I would be spending the rest of the life by myself.
I didn't go anywhere, didn't do anything. I didn't want to do anything. I was pretty depressed and I was pretty alone. I just had my own little life. And then I met Stephen and he just exploded my bubble.
Do you feel like she woke you up from a bubble?
No. I brought myself out of my bubble, you know, 5 years ago. But I'm just adding, and I keep adding. She's my soulmate that's just walked back into my life, and we've got to appreciate the time that we have together, and we've got to live life to the fullest, because you just don't know when your journey's going to end.
They may not know when their journey's ending, but they're definitely making the most out of it while they're on it. And I got to see them out together, doing just that.
We are at the Guns N' Roses concert. I'm with my first love, Tracy. I'm with Donna, the carer, one of my carers and her best friend. And Donna's job is to keep me in my wheelchair if I get drunk. The rules are with the Adelaide Oval. I know all the rules.
Oh, here we go.
They actually serve their drinks in plastic cups.
Yes.
So if they see us with a can,
yes,
they know we've smuggled it in.
Yes.
So we got to buy two plastic cups, right? And we got to fill them up with a bourbon.
Oh, my Lord. Are you worried that they'll check you?
They don't normally check somebody in a wheelchair, apparently.
If I was Corby, I would never have got caught. I haven't got my legs, I haven't got my eyes, but I've got my ears, and I've got my drinking arm. I got some punning to do.
That story was made by Carrie Shear, with thanks to Stephen Lambert and Tracy Billaby, and help from supervising producers Tegan Nichols and Selena Shannon. You're listening to All the Best, and in this episode, we're talking about picking up the pieces with two stories from South Australia. In 2011, Saskia Scott lost her mother. During the grieving period that followed, Saskia found herself surrounded by reminders of her mum, bits and pieces left behind, her belongings, but mostly her piles of clothes. Now, years on, Saskia has found a way to deal with the grieving process through her ceramic art practice. Ellie Parnell brings us this next story.
I feel like now is the perfect time for me to do this. My mum passed away in December 2011, and I've only really been working in this way and talking about these issues for the last 6 months, and I don't think I could have tackled it before. It was just, like, too emotionally raw.
Saskia Scott. She's a visual artist based in Adelaide, South Australia, and she specialises in ceramics and creating sculptural works.
At the moment, my practice deals with themes around grief and loss and absence, and I'm working on a project that talks about my experience of grief after the death of my mother in 2011. So I'm using the ceramic medium and her clothing to talk about my own experience of losing her. My work's created by taking items of my mum's clothing that I've selected and putting them in porcelain slip that I've stained with components to make it black when it's fired, and I then present them or like lay them out in ways that I feel sort of talks about my experiences with grief, or like interesting sort of visual forms, and fire them, and I get in the kiln, it goes to 12-20 degrees Celsius. The fabric burns away and I get left with a black porcelain version of whatever clothing I'm working with. And so I sort of manipulate them to form like stacks of clothing neatly folded, like when you take someone's clothes that's passed away and fold them up to store them away, or chaotic piles, which is sometimes how it feels when you end up with like all this stuff from someone who's no longer here and you don't quite know how to deal with it or where to start.
I spent a morning with Saskia in her ceramic studio to see the processes that she uses to create these interesting works.
Yeah, like I had so much clothing, like boxes and boxes, if you think about how much clothing people keep over their lives, and some of it was, you know, just, you know, camis or T-shirts from Target that weren't that precious, and there were heaps of them. So in my initial testing, I used things that were less precious. I'm sort of building up as I gain confidence using things that I have a more emotional attachment to. So this beanie was one that my mum neutered. I grew up on a little bit of a hobby farm. We had a couple of sheep and goats, and we used to shear them, and mum would spin the wool and then knit hats and bits and bobs like that. So this one was hers, but she also made one for my dad that was his favourite. And yeah, so we have this like really soft 100% wool object that she made, and I have chosen to use it in my practice because I like the idea that it sort of like creates a work that we both contributed to. She chose the pattern and knitted it and created the form, and by dipping it in clay and manipulating it, I've like contributed to that and created something that we both made. One of the really like interesting things about this is going through mum's clothing and finding the things that she kept, because like a lot of the clothes are really familiar to me because they're things she wore like late in her life that I saw heaps or remember her wearing, or were special occasion clothes that I can remember her wearing particular occasions. And then there's just clothes and bits and bobs that I'm like, where was this from? Or like, when did she wear this? Like, I think there's a jumper that would have been hers when she was like 14, because it's so really small. Must have been from childhood. And so that's been really interesting, like, because she wasn't really a hoarder. Like, what did she keep and why did she... why did she choose to keep these particular things? And when I was going through, like, sorting through her stuff, I, like, was checking the pockets of things to sort of... just in case. And in one of her coats, there was this hanky that has, like, it's really fine lace, really beautiful hanky with... I think it's souvenir from Brussels or something like that, written in another language, I imagine French. I don't have any personal recollection of this handkerchief. I don't know where it's come from, but it was just in her pocket. I assume that she bought it on one of her trips to Europe. It's kind of exciting to use things with those like really interesting textures in my work as well. That's like a real visual element to the piece. I do think that like by the time the clothes have passed through this process, they're not so recognisable as the original objects. I think that's part of why they lose the emotional weight when they pass through, because they're no longer the colourful pattern top that mum used to wear, you know, on these kind of occasions. They've become this sort of black object that has a totally different texture, and you wouldn't necessarily be able to link them back to the original object. So the thing that's really important for me in my art practice is that the materials that I'm using and the method that I'm using to make the work ties in and builds and adds to my concept or the themes that I'm trying to address. Like, I think what feels like it's right about this body of work is that I'm not just using ceramics because I like working with ceramics. I'm using ceramics because it allows me that process of taking the original object and letting it burn away and getting left with a new object. So it builds and adds to the meaning of the work, I guess.
That story was by Ellie Parnell and was first broadcast on Radio Adelaide. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Selena Shannon, our Victorian State Coordinator is Beck Fari, our Community Coordinator is Chloe Gillespie, Beth Gibson is our SYN Production Manager, Tegan Nichols compiles our show, and I'm Jess Hamilton. Thanks again to the producers of this week's stories, both first-time contributors to the show. Our artwork is designed by Annie Hamilton, and our theme music is composed by Shining Bird. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter and also find our archives at allthebestradio.com. While you're at it, subscribe to our podcast on your favourite podcast app.